So, next our news.
So this evening we've got David Lee, who is an retired
archivist.
There you go, that's the word.
Yeah. You're all along with it, wasn't it?
Retired what?
One of those.
I was Barrett from the audience last time I talked about this, so. And was it Dorset? Anyway, David is here to show us some old films that he, as an
archivist,
has looked after. And I'll leave it at that.
Right. Right.
Thank you.
Good evening. Good to see such a brilliant turnout. I hope you can hear me at the back, can you?
Yes, okay? Yes, thank you.
Good, yeah. Well, I've been retired 5 years now, so I've got to try and remember what I used to do. So I brought a few crib notes with me to tell you a little bit about the job that I used to do for Wessex Film and Sound Archive, which was based in Winchester, the obvious place for anything Wessex-based, unless you happen to be from Dorset, where, you know, you think everything there is Wessex. But in actual fact, the Kingdom of Wessex was in Hampshire for a while, so that's why we took up that title. It tripped off the tongue better than Central Southern England Film and Sound Archive, so that's why we chose that term. I'll tell you about the beginnings of it. There was a sort of, I don't know what you could call it, but there was a desire in the regions of the United Kingdom to have their own film and sound archives. And the film archives were the ones who were most restless at wanting to get set up. So one or two places, Scotland to start with, Manchester, East Anglia, they started their own regional film archives because it became obvious when you looked at the National Film Archive catalogue that there were huge gaps in terms of local material. And although there were, you know, a very good network of record offices for documents, maps and photographs, there weren't any particular ones relating to film and sound. And there was a known need for this because people realised that there was material out there that was going to be thrown away but was of local interest and maybe not national interest. So there was an urgency to get things started. So in 1986, the Southampton University had a speaker from the East Anglian Film Archive, which had only set up a short while before, extolling the virtues of having a regional film archive here in the south, central southern England. The university was kind of interested until they realised that the BBC collection, which was probably the largest one along with the ITV material that they could start with, wouldn't allow them to have any copyright access to it whatsoever. So they lost interest because there was no money to be made out of this material. So luckily, at the same talk, was the leader of the County Council, Freddie Emery Wallace, and he was very interested in our local history, for those who may have known him, and he decided that the County Council would take up the baton. But being Freddie Emery Wallace, he didn't want all of the cost to go to the County Council. So 1986, there was also a new body set up called the Hampshire Archives Trust, which is a charitable body set up specifically to act between the owners of archives and the holders of archives, such as the three record offices that existed in Hampshire at the time, in Winchester, Southampton and Portsmouth. And he wanted to extend their acquisitions to include film and sound. But he wasn't able to do that straight away. Obviously he had to establish the trust and get that going with the help of the County Council, I should add, but also with member subscriptions. And after a couple of years, he got his way and they were able to establish the Wessex Film and Sound Archive through the Hampshire Archives Trust at Winchester. And I was the person who was the first archivist there. I was called an archivist at the time, senior archivist, Wessex Film and Sound Archive. And I had a small office next to the Great Hall in Winchester, for those of you who know, used to be a law office. And that was the only place they could place me, because the actual record office was in an old church in Winchester, and they didn't have room for me at the time. And so we started with nothing, and I always say that the first 5 years of our establishment was the best for the actual collections that we managed to get, because that's the material that I think was the actual best material that the Film and Sound Archive managed to achieve to, you know, actually look after or at least advise on its best conservation and storage. So my job straight away was to go out there into the Wessex area. Now, we define that as central southern England, which could be just about anything that we wanted. It wasn't the ancient capital of Wessex for nothing, but we couldn't include outliers like Somerset or Oxfordshire at the time. So we just sort of stuck with Hampshire to start with, the Isle of Wight, of course, which actually used to be part of Hampshire back in the 19th century, and little bits of Berkshire, Dorset, and even bits of West Sussex at the time. And so we established our area more or less based on the BBC South television area. That was my main aim. This was because I used to work for BBC South in Southampton, and this was my first job as an actual archivist. So I went out there, and we collected a wide range of material from individuals who had taken film as an amateur of the local area. One chap who owned a carpet shop in Warsash, for instance, had taken films locally, including the establishment of the Loxwood Centre right from its beginnings. That kind of thing might seem, you know, fairly recent, but in time that will become of historical interest. So other amateurs have material going back to the 1930s, which is very interesting. We had particularly good material from Portsmouth in that respect. And then we had the corporations who might have had advertising films. Unfortunately, most of those have been thrown away when they became redundant, you know, taken over by new forms of advertising. But some have managed to hold on to their old films and sound recordings, and we were able to get some of those. And then we had the really large collections at BBC South and ITV Meridian, and we were able to copy some of their material, which hitherto had only been available to the filmmakers and production staff at those establishments, and we were able to make copies on video that the general public could see for the first time, things that they may have remembered seeing on their TV sets in the past, and obviously would never see them again unless we were able to provide them with the means to do that. And in time, actually, we were able to actually take in collections from those two places. So we added considerably to the numbers of items that we hold in the Wessex Film South Archive today. In fact, we now have about 40,000 film and sound materials based since 1988 in Winchester. Now, one of the big years for us was 1993, when the new record office in Hampshire opened in Winchester, in Sussex Street, and it enabled us to move in with them, with our own area for people to come in and do their viewing and listening, as well as having our own storage area. And that made a big difference. And I'll always remember when the building was officially opened by the Queen and Prince Philip. And I was able to take them to, we had our own cinema next door to our section, where we were able to show them home movies of them visiting Winchester back in the 1950s. And, you know, you had little comments from the Prince, for instance, saying, I remember that hat. And I sort of did a little commentary over the silent film. And I was saying, well, Winchester College, which you visited, the Queen visited at the time, she gave them 6 days holiday. And I mentioned this, and he said, they wouldn't get that now. So it's very interesting, you know, to get that kind of response, which, of course, I was getting from my film shows to general audiences anyway. And they enjoyed looking around our area, and looking at the equipment and what we did, talking to our volunteers. Two of our volunteers were there that day, and they were thrilled to meet the Queen and talk to her about what they were doing. And so that helped our profile quite a lot. And one of the other things that I think I should mention that was a policy of ours right from the word go was to encourage oral history recordings, the recordings of people's memories of the past. I did a few to start off with involving cinema projectionists who remembered back to the 1930s of how they used to deal with films in those days. And then I got equipment through the Trust and was able to lend it out to individuals and local history groups so that they could do their own oral history recordings with me doing the training so that they could come back with good material for preservation in the archive. They would get a copy on a cassette in those days, and we would build up our memory of the past in audio form. We also had a lot of material from places like Radio Victory. That was our first collection when they closed in Portsmouth. They were a commercial radio station, but they actually had some very interesting documentaries about things like the the raising of the Mary Rose, subjects like that. Also a lot of adverts, which I thought were very interesting and worth keeping, because they are a kind of social document, if you like, of the time, how people used to look at things that were advertised. And then Radio Solent passed on their material to us as well. And we had a number of other independent local radio stations who were very pleased to hand on their old tapes to us. And eventually these were digitised in a project which was run through Bournemouth University. They have a very large media school, and they wanted to put this material up on the internet so that their students and the general public could have access to this material. And it's interesting that this is the very much the trend now is to digitise film and sound and make it available on the internet in various guises. There's YouTube, of course, there are academic websites, and there's also BFI Player is a new one that has quite a lot of regional film material on that. It's worth a look. It's free to view, so it's an interesting site from our point of view.
So if somebody wanted to have access to your material,
yeah,
how would they do it? Because I know my mother-in-law did something or other for the History Society of Welland, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got a cassette, but it'd be nice to get online to find.
Yes, I mean, there obviously only a selection is available online, but Wessex Film and Sound Archive has its own website, so there's a number of items that, you know, we're continually putting more and more stuff on. And obviously the BFI Player has a number of our items as well. And, you know, this is happening more and more, but of course it takes funding to achieve. So this is one of the things that is difficult to get funding, but generally done through projects nationally with colleagues in the other regional film and sound archives. Anyway, I think I've said enough. I don't think there's anything else worth mentioning, really. We did a lot of... I did over 300 film shows throughout the region, and mainly to local history groups, of course, but, you know, it's very good to be able to carry on doing that with the material that I've been allowed to carry on showing. The material I brought today was chosen by Alan from a list that I gave him of material that I'm allowed to show, and he very wisely chose some light-hearted material for this particular occasion, and I hope that you'll enjoy what I'm about to put on the screen for you.
Right.
I'll have to wait while it warms up. Well, I'm going to start with a Humphrey Jennings wartime film called Words for Battle. This was obviously a propaganda film. Yes, it's the Crown Film Unit, if you may have heard of that, and Humphrey Jennings worked for them throughout the Second World War, and Words for Battle was one of his.
Cities, fair boroughs, good towns, and well-built villages. Methinks I see in my mind a mighty and puissant nation, rousing herself like a strong man after sleep, and shaking her invincible locks. Methinks I see her as an eagle, mewing her mighty youth, kindling her undazzled eyes at the full midday beam, purging and unscaling her long-abused sight at the fountain itself of heavenly radiance. While the whole noise of timorous and flocking birds, with those also that love the twilight, flutter about, amazed at what she means, and in their envious gabble would prognosticate a year of sects and schisms. Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear. O clouds, unfold. Bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. St. Vincent, to the northwest died away. Sunset ran, one glorious blood red, reeking into Cadiz Bay. Bluish mid the burning water, full in face, Trafalgar lay. In the dimmest northeast distance, dawned Gibraltar, grand and grey. Here and here did England help me. How can I help England? Say, whoso turns as I this evening, turn to God to praise and pray, while Jove's planet rises yonder, silent over Africa. It was not part of their blood. It came to them very late, with long arrears to make good, when the English began to hate. It was not suddenly bred, it will not swiftly abate through the chill years ahead, when time shall count from the date when the English began to hate. We shall go on to the end. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if this island were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world with all its power and might steps forth to the rescue and liberation of the old. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work they have thus far so nobly advanced, that we here highly resolve that the dead shall not have died in vain, that the nation shall, under God, have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
I just changed the disc. Right, the next one is called Your Cunard Holiday to America, 1965, aboard the Queen Elizabeth. I've chopped out some of it to cut it down to 20 minutes, so it's mainly the stuff on board ship. So I hope you enjoy it. It came from the basement of Southwestern House in Southampton, where Cunard used to have its offices, and was one of only a few that I managed to rescue, because apparently the basement used to flood twice a year and a lot of material had deteriorated beyond redemption by the time I got there.
Thank you. coins that have lured travellers across the Atlantic ever since the discovery of the New World. Crossing the United States and Canada are hundreds of thousands of miles of highways. Highways that lead to great cities, north, south, east, and west. That climb to Rocky Mountain heights for views of far horizons. Or skirt the golden sands of tropic seas. There are roads that wind back through the byways of history and take you through the charm of quiet countrysides, or lead views of nature's most awesome creations. No wonder that every year more and more holiday travelers from Britain and the continent sail across the Atlantic to see America for themselves. Today, an ocean crossing is so easy to make. Modern Cunard liners sail from all these ports to the United States or Canada. The Queen Elizabeth or the Queen Mary sails weekly from Southampton and Cherbourg, the only weekly express service across the Atlantic. Your Atlantic holiday may begin in London, where you board one of Cunard's special express trains from Waterloo Station to Southampton. Southampton's ocean terminal is one of the few docks in the world big enough to accommodate the Queen Elizabeth or the Queen Mary. These ships each exceed 80,000 tons, by far the largest superliners afloat. The precision schedules maintained by these ships fulfill the dream of Samuel Cunard, who more than 120 years ago founded the first regularly scheduled service across the Atlantic. The Queen's 2,000 passengers have come from everywhere. Many are experiencing their first ocean voyage. Once the great ship is nosed about and heads down Southampton Water, it's only a short run across the channel to Cherbourg, where we're joined by travellers from the continent. In the open sea, the ship becomes a world in itself, a travelling community of businessmen, diplomats, artists, teachers, students, and vacationing families from every walk of life. To first-time ocean voyagers who never before have travelled on anything bigger than a train, a superliner presents a new dimension in travel. The Queen Elizabeth is longer than three soccer fields. The ship has 14 decks, served by 35 lifts. It's like a city afloat, with more than a score of air-conditioned public rooms, lounges, deck squares, and shops. There are quiet libraries and writing rooms for reading, study, and correspondence. A choice of first-class staterooms and suites, or economical cabin class and tourist class accommodations, provides a wide variety to suit every taste and budget. Personal services include barber shops, beauty salons, Turkish baths, massage, and valet service. In cabin and tourist, dress is always informal. In first class, a dinner jacket is optional. In the evening of our first full day at sea, there's a gala get-together dance. It's easy to get acquainted. Just change partners and dance. The Queen Elizabeth has two fine orchestras and headline entertainers. climax of the evening is the balloon dance. Prizes are awarded to couples who hold their balloons longest. After a night of refreshing sleep, a leisurely breakfast in your stateroom sets the holiday mood for a typical day at sea. Where else but on a Queen can one enjoy acres of playground while speeding from continent to continent? You are assured of smooth sailing because the great ship is equipped with two sets of anti-roll stabilizers. Shuffleboard and deck tennis are among the favorite deck sports. There's plenty of enclosed deck space for playing the popular paradise tennis and ping pong. For those of us less athletically inclined, there's another exciting competition. This is the daily tote, short for totalizator. You place a bet on the number of miles you think the ship will travel in 24 hours, from noon to noon. The tote closes at 11:55. As the noon whistle blows, officers on the bridge check the ship's position. Today the ship has travelled 730 miles, so those holding 7:30 win the money. 730 is a lot of mileage when you realise that the Queen's 158,000 horsepower engines propel an entire floating holiday resort, a resort which can entertain more guests than most of the largest hotels on land. But what's going on here? Looks like old-fashioned musical chairs. Each game is a contest with handsome souvenir prizes for the winners. In this contest, the bar is gradually lowered. Can she make it? Too bad. If you always wanted to play in a band, the Skiffle Band is the one for you. All you need is rhythm.
Up, down, up, down.
Among the ship's many features are two saltwater swimming pools. The widescreen theater shows first-run films, often before their release on land. There are many places in the ship to play chess, cards, or other games. Passengers find the club-like atmosphere and service of lounges and smoking rooms ideal for a quiet afternoon or evening of bridge. Shopping is another rewarding pastime. Every Cunarder has a variety of shops filled with merchandise from Britain and the continent. handbags, perfumes, gifts, souvenirs, and everyday needs. There is sportswear and accessories for men and women. English and Scottish woolens, sweaters, and scarves. When it's time for tea, you may enjoy it wherever you happen to be. In public rooms, your own stateroom, or on deck. One of the many delights of travelling on a Cunarder is that with all the things there are to do, you don't have to do anything at all. One of the many popular spots for just taking it easy is the observation bar and lounge. Here you may meet your friends and enjoy your favorite drinks. During cocktail hours before lunch and dinner, service includes hot and cold canapés. By the way, traveling by sea isn't just for grown-ups. It's for the whole family, and it's ideal for children. Experienced trained nurses are in charge of playrooms, a wonderful convenience for parents on holiday. Children love being able to play and work off some of their natural energy, especially at parties. When visiting friends came aboard at Southampton to wish us bon voyage, they may have wondered whether all the Epicurean delights displayed on the buffet were to be eaten or were merely for decoration. Was your first Cunard sailing, you yourself may have wondered. If you did have any doubts, the first dinner served at sea dispelled them forever. In the Cunard Queens, the first class restaurants can accommodate all passengers at a single sitting. This is a small corner of the Queen Elizabeth's main restaurant, which seats 780 guests in luxurious space and comfort. Variety on every menu is bewildering. If your favorite is missing, the chefs will be delighted to prepare it. Your choice of fish, game birds, or the finest cuts of seasoned prime meats from both sides of the Atlantic. Where else but on a superliner can you dine in such leisure and luxury? Many first-class passengers consider dinner at sea the perfect occasion for wearing evening dresses and dinner jackets, though less formal wear is not out of place. After dinner activities are too many to illustrate, movies, bingo, and dancing to mention a few. A special event tonight is a headdress parade, in which prizes will be awarded for the most original designs. Night owls, who enjoy a nightclub atmosphere, there is late evening music, dancing, and entertainment. With all there is to do aboard a Cunarder, it's no wonder travelers agree that getting there is half the fun. Time crossing the Atlantic flies so quickly, it seems like no time at all, until the ship has steamed through the Narrows into New York Harbor. and we're passing the Statue of Liberty, presented by the people of France to the people of the United States. On our starboard side, morning sunlight and river mist silhouette the skyscraping panorama of Lower Manhattan. We're steaming up the Hudson River, named for the English explorer who sailed up it in 1609, after crossing the Atlantic in a tiny ship, little bigger than the tugs that cluster round the Queen. As the great ship approaches the pier, the surging power of the tugs is directed from the bridge high above. Press cameramen and reporters come aboard to photograph and interview celebrities on the passenger list, perhaps movie stars or international diplomats. Passengers are ready to disembark. And soon, moored at her pier, the Queen looks down on Midtown New York's busy West Side Highway, a stone's throw from the shops, hotels, and business buildings that line the city's broad avenue. Whichever Atlantic holiday you've chosen, when your short excursion comes to an end in New York or Montreal, a friendly Cunard liner is waiting to welcome you home. Here in Montreal, it will be one of the beautiful ships in Cunard's Canadian service, the Carinthia, the Carmania, or the Franconia. For those who embark at Montreal, farewell views of America will include the skylines of Montreal and Quebec, and passing vistas along the great St. Lawrence River on the way to the open sea. If our departure for home is from New York, in the Queen Elizabeth or the Queen Mary, we'll say farewell to the skyline of Manhattan as we begin another 5 days of carefree luxury at sea, gourmet dining in the Queen's famous restaurants, music, dancing, gay entertainment, salt air and sunshine, with cheerful service on every hand. Of all our holiday memories, none will remain more vivid than those of the great ship which has been our home away from home, our happy vacation island at sea.
Where would that have been shown? Well, from Southampton on board. Yeah. Right, well, we'll finish with a festive feast of fun. This is the an organisation I used to belong to called the Cinema Theatre Association, made up of people who used to work in cinemas and those who are interested in their architecture. And every year we would be given a book or a DVD, which we could purchase for a reasonable price. And the DVDs were made up by members of the CTA, usually former projectionists who'd squirreled away films from their sort of period when they were employed. I should hasten to add, a lot of these films would have been thrown away otherwise. And so I'm just going to show you a sort of very brief selection of adverts and trailers going back to the 1950s up to about the 1980s. So I hope you enjoy them. We'll start with an excerpt from The Smallest Show on Earth, if you remember that film. Just to get proceedings started.
Good morning. Be sure to keep the lunch on service.
Search for happy readers. The Daily Sketch goes everywhere, sees everything.
I'm from the Daily Sketch. Sorry about that. Oh, there's a lady who looks a likely reader. How do you do? Oh, silly me. Ah, now there's a fine figure of a man. Hey, you, sir, I'm sure you read the Daily Sketch, Sports Report, Cartoon, ooh. No sense of humor. I heard that. I'll have you know we've all got a sense of humor on the Daily Sketch. And so ends another interview by the Daily Sketch, the paper that isn't afraid to make fun of anyone or anything, not even afraid to laugh at itself.
Corselet by Silhouette. Figure molding keep shape cups give you a permanently lovely line. Unique X panels emphasize the waist, flatten the tummy. A downstretch panel slims you at the back. In new elastic net with 100 denier bri nylon. Little extra corselet with keep shape cups by Silhouette.
Something for everyone.
Raspberry ripple, please, Daddy. Orange bark for me, Dad.
Ooh, a chalk ice.
I'm taking home a family brick for tea.
We always stop when we see this sign.
Midland Counties.
Quash for flavour, quash for fun, the party drink for everyone. Orange,
orange,
lemon,
lemon,
bitter lemon too. It's the capital taste with the capital Q. Q-bidoo-bidoo, it's quash.
The Rimmel Beauty on a Budget series, all that's best for beauty, all at 1 in 3, enables the career girl in a hurry to choose a cosmetic wardrobe in the minimum time. The housewife with a limited budget to afford the best in cosmetics, and the teenager to experiment with new fragrances, new makeup, and new shades.
Choose from the Rimmel Beauty on a Budget tray.
All that's best for beauty, all at 1 in 3.
Get Pears! The brand new sweet that's fun to offer and fun to eat. Fun to offer because the pack's brand new. Just flip the top, there's a Pears for you. A Pears that's fresh and clean and neat. Fun to offer and fun to eat. Pears!
The top name in toiletries for men.
H-E men feel good. H-E for His Excellency. H-E men look good. H-E for His Excellency. H-E men smell good. H-E for His Excellency.
Completely masculine in presentation.
So that they disperse instantly in water, no waiting for them to dissolve. The special Cephas ingredients are quickly assimilated into the system, rapidly absorbed by the bloodstream, and sent speedily into action. Cephas soon clears your headache away, relaxes your nerves, and eases your depression. Here, they really do work. What do you call them again? Cephas powders. See what? Cephas.
Is now on sale in the foyer.
Be sociable. Have the Pepsi.
In one superb show. Here is matchless story, suspenseful, terrifying, never so thrillingly presented. Here in breathtaking technicolor is superb spectacle and splendor and romance. Here is a chorus of 100 voices, a ballet of 100 dancers, a cast of 1,000, starring Nelson Eddy in his most vigorous performance, lovely Susanna Foster, and Claude Rains in the most coveted role of the year as the Phantom of the Opera.
My music! You've stolen it! You've stolen my music!
Shape up properly. Scientifically, of course. I've done a lot of experimenting with this kind of thing.
You can come in now, if you're not too busy.
Miss Laurel was just showing me her acetates.
It all began when Rudolph, the chimp, discovered the formula for eternal youth that makes people grow younger and younger and younger.
Edwina, what I have to tell you is unbelievable.
Oh?
Oh, well, I'll start at the beginning. Edwina, at 11:52 this morning, I took a dose of the formula. And in a few minutes, I began to behave exactly like a college boy. Well, all set?
Is your motor running?
It's yours? Takes a while to warm up.
That's me too. By the way, whose lipstick is it?
What's her name? You know, Oxley's secretary.
Oh, you mean that little pin-up girl, huh? Very cute.
Sort of, but half infant.
Not the half that's visible. Hi, Dr. Fulton.
Hi.
What'd you say to her? Mrs. Fulton, he said hi. I heard what he said, you peroxide kissing bug.
Edwina, she didn't do anything.
I'll pull that blonde hair off by its black roots.
Edwina, please. Edwina,
come
stop
on,
it. Miss Laura, you keep out of the way.
Have to stop it there, but hope you enjoyed the extracts I did show you.
Any questions? Any reminiscence?
Kiora, I do remember Kiora.
Oh, yes, yes.
Boy, how was there? And there are other points as well, but I've forgotten them now.
Is the archive still running? I mean, you've retired
now. Oh, yes, yes, it's still going. Yeah, yeah. And you can still visit in Winchester without making an appointment and just go and see and listen to, you know, thousands of items. Yeah.
It's something on the radio now, isn't it? It's just a few minutes and it's people talking and it's reminiscent of times gone by.
So yeah, yeah.
It's sort of de rigueur, it's in vogue, isn't it?
Oh, definitely, yeah, yeah.
Is it on the web as well?
Yes, I mean, a lot of material isn't digitised yet, but you can look at the catalogue online and see what sort of material they hold. Yeah.
How did you get material from individuals to advertise?
It was a mixture of, yes, advertising through... you know, having articles written about me, going on television and radio, and also being in touch with the amateur filmmakers groups, which you know, this country's got a fine tradition of. So I used to go along to their events and things like that. So I'd get known. Yeah.
Digitization is only as good as the computer it sits on.
Yes, that's right.
How do we ensure austerity?
Well, you have to keep changing from one platform to another as things change. Unfortunately, there's no way of getting over that. There's no sort of set in stone digital.
Do you always ensure that you have the hard copy?
Oh, the original, yes. Yes, I mean, that's the reason why no film or sound is thrown away unless it's actively deteriorating or endangering its neighbours. Yeah. Yes, I mean, the worst place you can keep these things is in a shed or a loft because of the changes in humidity, temperature throughout the seasons. Doesn't do plastics any good at all, as you may have discovered if you looked at your old photos. And that's why some of these films look faded, because the last colour to go to fade is red. And that's why a lot of them had a red kind of cast to them. And certainly the ones that I discovered it from Cunard in the basement, a lot of them suffered from that.
You're welcome.